friends will open their meeting with prayer. Almighty and eternal Father, we thank thee again that we can gather together to worship you in spirit and truth, find our relationship to the pattern of events round about the eye of thy spirit, with the key of thy word. We're thankful for the eternal nature of thy kingdom, for the assurance of ultimate victory, for thy abiding presence. Pray as we meditate upon the things that are transpiring round about, that you'll give us not only understanding, but the courage to battle the darkness and to lift up thy standards. So we say, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and we ask it. Amen. There's another meeting tonight in the embassy, and a great number of people are attending that meeting tonight. Mr. Cotton is here from Louisiana, where he moved recently, and we can understand people wanting to hear what he's had to say. Probably no man over the radio has come out to attack the Jews and their connection with communism any more openly than Mr. Cotton has over the last few months. So it's rather significant that Mr. Cotton tonight down the embassy is here speaking on the questions. There are no holds barred, so there'll be quite a few people who have gone down to hear him. We turn in our thinking tonight, there are a lot of things of increasing interest. The great reaction wave that is setting in, coming from all over the nation, is becoming more and more obvious. After the Supreme Court decision at the beginning of this week concerning the declaration that communists don't have to register, virtually nullifies that area of the Smith Act and also the remedial legislation which Congress had taken to help combat the Communist Party. So this is, we can tell you what's happening. When we look at our mail and we see the wave of reaction, when the telephone calls come from all over the country, and in the meetings we've been in, San Francisco, Oakland, Central Valley, Mariposa, Merced, all this week everywhere, people from service clubs, Kiwanis, Lions, Exchange, all kinds of civic-minded institutions, but they're angry. They're totally angry at the decisions of the Supreme Court. I've heard more people talking about impeachment proceedings, and if they can't impeach them, hang them. I've heard more of that this week than you've ever heard. Say, why is it? Because they actually feel, people actually have decided that the decisions of the Supreme Court have been designed to aid and abet the Communist Party. The Communist Party not only demonstrates that they take it this way too, because this week we've had Gus Hall and others saying that this is the greatest decision that has ever been made for the Communist Party. Now they have a go-ahead sign to organize openly, carry out the various objectives of their party, and they don't have to worry about it without, they'll work now without fear. Automatically this week also in Berkeley, a number of those involved in the student demonstrations identify themselves now as communists since they didn't have to and there was no fear, they said, involved. On top of this, of course, there are teachers involved in this who also are now identified as communists in this past week. We point out to you again that the city of Oakland is faced tomorrow with massive demonstrations, calling it Vietnam Day and the protest being against the Vietcong War. Actually, however, it's just a protest against anything that the communists want protested against. It's a massive use of students. There'll be over 20,000 supposedly involved tomorrow. The city of Oakland would not give a permit for parade or would not permit the demonstration. So they appealed it to a district court. The judge said in San Francisco, who presided over it, that they would have the right to parade tomorrow, that the city of Oakland could not stop them parading. They could demonstrate, but they had to stay away from embarkation points and the shipping points of the Navy and their peers, their army peers. So they had to stay away from this area. They couldn't demonstrate around these areas, but that they would have to let them demonstrate. The resulting condition is the city of Oakland called on the governor to supply National Guard. And the governor wouldn't say whether he would or would not supply National Guard, but because of fear of mass riots, why, it looks as though there will be some use of guardsmen. During the period of the last demonstration, in which you remember the city of Oakland would not let them parade in Oakland. But they came down out of Berkeley and they went down Telegraph Road, which is, if you know Oakland, comes right up to the edge of Oakland and over by the MacArthur Freeway. And there they were halted. They were not permitted to go any farther. Lines of Oakland police, motorcycle squads, well armed, would not permit them to go on. But all the time that the law enforcement was lined up to stop the parade from going any farther and from the demonstration, the Negroes were looting and raiding all over throughout the residential areas and through various business districts of Oakland. They tried to keep this down, but they broke windows and they stole and they raided and they looted. And there was a tie-in between the Negro rioting and looting and the demonstrations. Rather significant thing that in the instance of all these mass demonstrations, the policies and procedures of the Oakland Police Department was to keep order, because they had had some tip-off concerning this type of action, and they fully intended not to permit this thing to come to fruition if they could help it. It's a matter of significance, too, that like Detroit this past week, the city of Oakland and also San Diego have had the highest crime wave they've had for many, many weeks. Assault, attack, rape, violence, breaking into properties with some occupied and some with the people at home. But it's been the highest rate of burglary, assault, and also rape that the city of San Diego's had, that Detroit has had. I have here bulletins from Detroit as well as from San Diego concerning this. And in the city of Oakland, it was so bad that they're carefully warning people to stay off the streets at night. Do not come out to meetings, or do not go anywhere you don't have to go. And if you go at all to any place, only go when there's sufficient men to accompany you and when you have sufficient assurance that transportation to and from will not be obstructed. Well, it's a rather strange thing in these United States where we have to leave communists and left-wingers and emotionally immature minority groups determine what Americans are going to do. Well, we had a meeting on Tuesday night. It was a rather interesting situation because we spoke Monday in San Francisco, where we've spoken, of course, for many years. In Oakland, we had a good meeting. But as we just before we started that meeting, several students from Berkeley were there and said, "Dr. Swift, there's been a rumble on the campus. There's talk that this meeting will be invaded by a number of students who are going to disrupt the meeting. They're not going to let you speak. So this is what one of the things they're going to do. They're going to come into this auditorium and they're going to disturb the meeting." Well, I said, "I don't think that we'll have very much disturbance. You see, this isn't a high school auditorium, and the church rents this auditorium, and we'll hold a meeting." So these students who had warned us of this were students not only friendly, but some of whom we know, some of you actually enrolled there on the campus in courses from our own congregations. So in the course of this, we have our own master of arms. We have ample men and young men who know how to hold peace in a meeting. So we started our meeting, and when the meeting had barely started, when in came a line of students, and they sat across the front rows. Well, as we were talking about the international situation, its relationship to the World Communist Offensive, and to the awakening reaction in America, and to the situations that were involved, they listened intently. It wasn't long before some of them had forgotten what they came for. Then I saw it start. One of them down here on the side started to motion to the other, and nobody paid attention to him. They were listening. So he had to shake them to make sure that they caught his attention. Then they passed a signal around. Then they waited till a point was made. Then they'd start to laugh, or they would seek to disrupt the meeting. So we stopped the meeting. Now I said, "I can understand the intellectual incapacity and the average Berkeley student today who belongs to this kind of movement to understand what we're talking about. If you're unable to understand this and you're an imbecilic classification, then at least be still. Don't disturb this meeting, because if you disturb this meeting, out you go. I'm not going to stop again, not going to warn you again. You're going to be still. We're going to hold this meeting, and if you seek to disturb this meeting, you're going to go out." They turned red as a beet, and they looked at one another, and then they stayed the rest of the meeting without a whimper. However, we did hear the remarks, there'd be more of them next time. There'll be more of us, too, so this will be all right. However, we've had an ample opportunity to see that there's two standards, even among the so-called liberals who want their liberal position. Here in the city of Los Angeles, we note how much opposition has been raised whenever there was objections against known communists speaking in our tax-supported institutions and in the various areas of our educational system. This was true also in the Palo Alto area. This was true at Berkeley. Gus Hall and Foster and others actually were speaking in these institutions. Of course, Baird Rustin and some of the others were speaking, Communist Party members, people with a long Communist Party background. And as they were attacking all the positions of the United States government, they were also attacking the whole structure of our civilization society. Now, opposition was well taken by vast numbers of citizens. that in our tax-supported institutions, people that were in total opposition to the government of the United States were serving a system that overthrow it, if necessary, by force, should not be permitted to use these schools. Immediately, the courts protected the communists in their right to use the schools or to speak in school auditoriums or even to address our student bodies. They said that it was a violation of the concept of the free speech not to permit anyone to speak at any time, and they would look with any hostility on any opposition to the permission of these communists to speak. I know of 7 occasions in which the permission was given and everything was, every override was taken to block any opposition to communist speaking. But in the city of Los Angeles this week, or rather in the Pasadena area, we have another picture. The Citizens Councils had speaking here in Pasadena this past week, the Sheriff Clark, who comes from Montgomery, Alabama. Now the fact is that all of the left-wing organizations, Commie Front organizations, Negro organizations, Jew organizations, put the pressure on. In fact, they even went to the courts to try to get an injunction to stop the man from speaking. So the liberals that are always wanting to suppress the conservatives, if there's any opposition to even traitorous action, now wanted to stop free speech when they disagreed with it. So you see, this idea whether you suppress somebody or let them talk just depends on what side you're on. So under this instance, the very organizations that were crying for free speech for communists wanted to stop Sheriff Clark from speaking. The judge, who was a liberal, made a very clear position. He said, we will not create any area of suppression on the right of free speech. He says, matter how much in disrepute the position of the speaker might be, which was not called for. However, he says the man cannot be forbidden to use the school auditorium or the group that has secured it for this evening. On the other hand, he says, you can't keep anybody out. So the resulting condition was that a bunch of pinkos and commies and a lot of the front movements and the core operation and the Southern Leadership Conference group, they moved in and they gained entrance to the building over an hour and a half ahead of time. They packed most of the seats of the building, and there was no place for the remainder of the people to sit because it was just a few minutes that was filled up. And many people that came to the meeting couldn't get into the meeting, and there were more on the outside. It took 100 police officers to try to hold the peace, but they didn't have the courage to keep the peace. But when Sheriff Clark was introduced and started to speak, the booing and the guffawing and the disruption of that meeting by these pinkos and these left-wingers was so great that he finally had to stop speaking. And when the organization who sponsored him asked for the police to silence the crowd, the police lacked the courage, wouldn't silence the crowd, and wouldn't touch the thing, and they had to call the meeting off, and Sheriff Clark had to leave. The next time, my friends, it shall be different in the city of Los Angeles, I'm assured, when they have a speaker like this. They didn't expect it. In San Diego, on Wednesday night, I believe it was, Sheriff Clark was to speak in San Diego. Here in San Diego, Negroes so surrounded the auditorium that white people had to fight their way through, elbow their way through, and be shoved around to get into the auditorium. In this instance, again, they tried to silence the speaker, but the speaker would not be silenced. More than that, he named them and told them who they were and what they were, and he laid it on the line, and the white people rallied to this fact, and the result was they held a meeting in San Diego. But in Pasadena, they didn't hold a meeting. But I'm going to tell you, you white people better learn how to hold a meeting, and if the enemy doesn't like it, you better then hold the meeting anyhow and decide it at the meeting. Because this situation is one of those kind of strategies which they're now undertaking everywhere, that if they cannot get their way, then they're going to take the law in their own hands and say you cannot assemble. Now, any time law and order breaks down and the police departments will not defend your right to peaceful assembly, you have the right to defend it yourself. Significant that in the reports that have been coming out concerning the blackout, there's ample evidence now that there were relays made to various parts of the area where the blackouts occurred over 8 states before the blackout occurred concerning the fact that there was going to be a blackout. For instance, telephone operators that handled some long-distance calls for to various areas, several of them reported in from various areas that they had calls that were person-to-person, and they had to be sure that the call was being completed. And so after the call was made, they waited a moment to make sure that everything was right before they got off the line. And one of the first things they heard, that when the lights go out and they realized the conversation was on and they hung up. and they didn't know whether it was the lights going out in the hotel or the lights going out in some shop as it closed, or whether it was just when the factory shuts down, the lights go out. They never thought about it. They never thought about it for about 15 to 20 minutes to a half an hour later when the lights went out. But several operators reported right in, and the information has been open, and the investigators know that the notice was from 15 minutes to a half hour, and one even an hour earlier before the lights went out, when communications were being made and instructions were being made by phone from one area to the other of what to do when the lights go out. As we mentioned to you, the Negroes drew cars across the roads in Rochester, New York. They blocked off the police. They started turning around in the roads before the lights went off, while the street lights were still on, and then they'd stall their car, and here there was half a dozen cars turning around the middle of the blocks, which of course would never happen anyhow. If one car stalled in a turnaround, that might happen, and if a second one did, this would really be a coincidence. But when six and seven cars in the block are in the process of turning before the lights go out and stalled in various places, and the moment the lights went out, they brought in more cars, it was more congested. Already groups of Negroes were looting property and houses, and the looters had come from across the city. In some instances, there were those that had left work early, a half an hour early, so that they could get to the place where they were supposed to be when the lights went out. Now, people don't normally leave their jobs, even Negroes, a half an hour early, to go across the city to meet other Negroes who were involved in looting and demonstration, and whose cars were even found across the pavement, all of which used the excuse afterwards that they were trying to turn around in the dark and they'd had car trouble, say. But the fact was that they had to bring in wave of special officers. They had to bring in special Klieg lights, which were operating on gas, acetylene, in order to have lights to see to handle the mob violence. Mob violence not only existed there, but also inside of Boston. And they had to call out troops in Boston to handle Negro looting, rioting, and assault in Boston when the lights were out. They've tried to tell you that nothing went on during the light out period, but a lot of things did go on. Everywhere, of course, as soon as the lights went out, white men lit candles and they tried to illuminate places, and lots of people thought it had its humor, but they were making the best of it. But I was rather interested. One investigator said, when white men light the candles, the Negroes start to loot and rape. So you see, it just makes a difference, my friends, who you are and how you think. One immediately thinks of the darkness to take advantage of everybody else. The other immediately thinks of lighting a light to help everybody because of the temporary predicament. The situation was not, my friends, an accident. It was something of design and plan. There were four areas where everything that was necessary at a nerve center went out, and they have not been able to give any explanation for why it went out, but they said it couldn't have gone out and coordinated the blackout over an area like this without a planned pattern of intelligence knocking four various areas out. And I have a report here on the areas knocked out, and they wouldn't all have happened at the same time and caused the flow back in some places and increased power factors in others. But the situation is that in this declaration, why the information proves that the thing was planned in time. And there were a lot of people that knew about it. And there were several other places in the United States that blacked out at the same time, but Edison and other companies were able to get the lights on again. There is a rather interesting report here of a federal control map for the United States, which is one of the Communist Party strategies. And the design was to organize eventually, of course, all the United States under various areas and various provinces. In other words, they want to divide up the states. They do not want a government made of 50 states, for instance, at that time 48, because the sovereignty of these states and the ability of states to resist the areas of federal tyranny and eventual socialism is quite obvious. So they want to divide up the whole nation into areas of provinces, and in some areas they decided on trying to use the procedure of authority. For instance, one of the top professors in the area of political science cited that we never can hope to take over this country with 48 strong state governments. To oppose, we must therefore get the states to depend more and more on the federal government for their very existence. We have a picture or a map here, he was using this, to show that this country is controlled by, can be controlled by nine river authorities, all of which will be dominated by the central government. The TVA is the reality, and he said we have many of our party members planted within this structure. Now we have Valley Authorities, MVA, the CVA, and so on, so all the nation's light and power can be controlled from a central force. If we want to suppress the people, if we want to use the shock treatment on them, we can plunge them into darkness at the moment that the pushing of a switch all over the country. Mrs. Munt was well informed, as was her husband, concerning the strategy and what Internal Security had found out concerning Communist Party plans and designs to totally put out the lights in America whenever they wanted to, and then to use this as a point of revolution. Computing, they'd cut off communication, they would cut off many of the power assists necessary for police and fire department coordination, as well as the communications across the nation. We reported to you that Internal Security told us when we were in Washington with Colonel Greer that they heard the plans that at that time could be carried out even more efficiently and now to plunge all the Los Angeles area into darkness, to blow up substations and destroy whole areas of the power carried system from Boulder Dam or Hoover Dam to the city of Los Angeles. And that was before we had as many diesel electric and steam plants as we have now. However, along with this, they had plans for fires, for knocking out communications, for tying up the telephone system by a different system, which was the dialing system, of course, leaving the last number off and blocking all of the entrances and exits into fire and police departments by telephone communication from payphones all over, coordinated till they had enough calling in to block all the trunk lines. This has been tried in many cities with dress rehearsal already, and they covered the meeting. They knew that this was the plan. And under the Supreme Court decisions that they can't do anything about what people advocate until they actually do it, they were unable to block the patterns and plans of conspiracy, though previously they were indicting or picking up people on these charges and holding them accordingly. Now the Supreme Court has virtually turned loose all the communists in the United States, and what you have to do is blow up the bridge, blow up the power supply, throw the cyanide in the water system, and then you can arrest the individual, and not before. But this, of course, violates all concepts of the laws concerning conspiracy and makes it very, very hard for a nation to defend itself. So if the government cannot take any action, if police departments cannot arrest conspirators that are planning on overthrowing your government or in creating these areas, if nothing can be done against agitators that stir up Negroes to race violence and carry out the strategies that produces Watts and produces Rochester and Philadelphia, or what Congressman Hawkins threatened last Saturday was going to happen to all of the communities in Southern California unless we gave the Negroes all the jobs they wanted, the kind of jobs they wanted, and pay them what they wanted. Now, I don't see where this is promised to anybody. No one's promised any job unless he knows how to fulfill the responsibilities of it, and nobody can be promised any wage he wants. It has to relate to what he's worth and what the standards for such services are worth. However, when Congressman Hawkins comes out to say that unless they get these jobs and this money, there's going to be rape, violence, and there's going to be riots all over the city. Now, this is what I want you to understand. That if there are no laws against conspiracy any longer, if there's no way to protect you until the riots start and they start burning buildings and burning hospitals, they tried in Antelope Valley to burn down a hospital. There is no responsibility among the Negroes when they will try to burn down a hospital in an area which is doing nothing but good for the people of the community. It has no political factor whatsoever. It's just their malicious viciousness when they go with emotional irresponsibility on the loose. Now, what's happening is happening all over California, and it's happening all over the nation. If they cannot block or stop these things before they start by such decisions, then an armed citizenry will stop it when it does start. Make no mistake about it. It must be clearly emphasized all over the nation that the citizenry will not stand for violence and for mass destruction of property and the endangering of life as we had it in this community, as they've even had it under this emergency in the East. Rather significant situation involved. It's rather interesting to point out also that another storm comes to light. There seems to be some deep political plots involved in a lot of the areas of our international action. We would make no protest against fighting communism anywhere at any time on the basis of its continued threat to our civilization, is designed to enslave the entire world. The factors involved in suppressing the expansion of communism have to be weighed for their political and their military stance as to what is valuable and what is not. There's no doubt that Red China wants all of Asia, wants all of North America. As automatically we've been talking about it, has actually had billboards showing Chinamen coming home with loot from America after the successful expeditions which they anticipate they're going to have to the North American continent. We've told you about textbooks showing the botany of the entire West Coast, of all of the United States, and what you can eat here in the plant. The average American wouldn't eat the things that are in the book, but a Chinaman would get a big dinner out of them because he's eating everything like this up in his own country. And many, many more herbs and things grow wild in our village, in our woods and along our roadsides than you have any idea. They've already listed what's food and what isn't, what they can eat. Against the day when they'll travel on their stomach to invade your land and attack your society. Now, there's no opposition to the concept of an expanding communist conspiracy seizing all of Asia and building its bridges for eventual attack against America is not dangerous. Or that a nuclear-empowered China would not be dangerous. With her new cyclotrons, with her amassing of nuclear weapons, there will be no part of the world that she can reach by any carrier that will be safe. Because they have a emotional a lack of emotion, and they have an implacable attitude towards their enemy, and they are less worried about how many lives are lost than anybody in the world. General Mao said, if I spend 30 million men to take North America, this would be of little consequence as compared to the value that North America will be to the Chinese. And so their talk about someday this being a Chinese continent, and that they're going to conquer it, and they're going to liberate the workers, and all of this along with it. Of course, you can understand what kind of liberation a white worker would get from invading communist hordes when they picture the communists going back with a little cord around the throat of white women being led back as captives along with all kinds of paraphernalia. They picture, and the billboard shows wheelbarrows going back with television sets and all kinds of appliances. I don't know what they do with them after they got them over there, but the fact is that what they were holding out was the loot. And these billboards and photographs of the type of propaganda that was being used shows they capture a vast amount of loot material, and then here the obvious pattern of the hauling away of great numbers of slaves. How do they reconcile this with the supposed story that communism is against slavery, that it wants to liberate society? All they're picturing themselves to be is a bunch of looting, plundering thieves hauling away female slaves for total depravity. And so this is the picture. But it's North America that's the goal. It's your assets and your possessions that they have in mind. It's your property that they intend eventually to live on after they've eliminated you. So this is a part of that communist objective. I make no objection to either the late President Kennedy or President Johnson or anybody else carrying a war on against the communists, whether it be in the VidCon or whether it be found anywhere else where their expanding power threatens other nations with us in mind. But I am totally opposed to any war in which we send any troops at any time without laying out a blueprint for them to win. I do not believe that you send any American boys, their officers, or your equipment into any circumstance unless that where you do not intend to win. I totally disagree with Mr. Nitze, who is now a high official in the Pentagon, who is speaking at the Assimilar Conference, who said that there are certain inevitable decisions that we have had to come to. One is that we are so overwhelmingly outnumbered by Africans, Asiatics, and peoples of other races, and that these people are fast turning to socialism and communism. So he said it will be quite impossible for us to win a victory against communism. Eventually, communism will win the world. The best thing we can do, therefore, is to fight a delaying action and then deal for the best deals we can get along the line to slow it down until maybe something will transpire that will modify it somehow. Instead of offensive weapons for carrying a war to our enemies, we must have limited weapons that will fight a deterring action without angering our enemies so much that they become punitive to even the annihilating point. So here we have this left-wing figure who I consider to be a traitor and one of the most dangerous men in the United States in the Pentagon, then at the Assimilar Conference before he was appointed, actually standing out to advise that we plan on a long program of surrender. It's just jockeying into position where we can maybe make the best deal by retarding the enemy. I think a person like this should have nothing to do with our armed forces or with our defense, because we don't form these defense programs and the vast military operations of our nation to retreat and surrender. We form them to enforce the will of a great and strong and powerful nation. This idea of going on the defensive all the time and then surrendering, and somewhere out there becoming a socialist Soviet state in some proportion, is pure idiocy. But it demonstrates the strategy with which the enemy is at work. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because we're living in the day of the Antichrist. We're living in the day of the super deceivers that move in your society. The Apostle Paul talks about them. Timothy has this contained in the epistles to Timothy. Peter tells you about this. Jude talks about this day. Some of these people have no spiritual capacities. They're referred to as brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed because they're warring against the things they have no spiritual capacity to understand, and they are seeking to destroy the civilization, the culture of the kingdom of God. Now, in this instance, you're told that the strategy will be to invade, to subvert, to destroy, to capture. Now, in the cause of stopping the VidCon, like the battle in Laos and other areas, we create a northern and southern area time after time. Then we divide a country, and then we have a permanently instituted communist administration on one side. North Korea divided back at the time of the World War II is like this as well. The communist structure in the north and the southern portion. Eventually, it is anticipated that all Korea is going to go communist. Eric Severoy and Drew Pearson. Drew Pearson came out this past week with a very strange and startling story. I have a copy of it here from the San Francisco Chronicle. The story is that in 1964, Mr. Stevenson said that facing the military strength of the United States, realizing that we meant business, that the Hanoi government offered to make peace. Then we have the story Mr. Stevenson told, that Mr. U Thant finally came and told our government that we could write the terms of the peace. But our government said no, that we didn't want to do it as yet. We wanted to make them understand that they had to make a peace. How Red China was trying to get Hanoi to go along with war, that they would support them. But Hanoi didn't want to take the plastering and bombing they were afraid they were going to get. So our government assures them that we're not going to bomb Hanoi, but we're not going to have peace either. We want to build up a war, and we want to show the world that we punish communists when they try to take over the world, as long as they fight for it. But that the plan was that at the end of a year's time, which would be sometime in 66, we would then agree to a discussion, and we would agree to a new type of coalition government between North and South Vietnam, Viet Cong and Vietnam, that it could be a communist government, but not aggressive and not bothering their neighbors. And so the design of these phony finks at the head of your government and in positions of power is that we fight a war, but the war is costing us thousands of men before we're through and costing the enemy lots of men. And then at the end, we'll make a peace of having demonstrated that we have great power. And we promise the enemy we're not going to bomb your cities or your factories, so don't worry about that. You just keep pouring in men, and we'll pour in men, and then you can have the whole thing. We're going to make it a communist area as long as it will be a peaceful one, and they win again. Now, this is explosive, and Mr. McNamara is in on it, and so Mr. McNamara this week said, no, this isn't true. There's no truth to this rumor. We were never offered any peace. The instance is, I'm not concerned about peace offers from communists if in the same instance they designed to get us only out of there to start all over again. But when there is a area of information exchanged by our government, until Mr. Stevenson knew about it before he died, and Hubert Humphreys knew about it, and that it was the strategy of officials in our government that were working their own program, who have no design to stop communism, but they were going to therefore make all of the Vietnam areas a coalition communist government as long as they would not continue their program of aggression. Now, frankly, as a Christian church, we take a different position than maybe many of the government officials would take. We are aware that communism is the total enemy of civilization. It is the enemy of the Christian faith and the Christian church. We call for constant, continual, and total war until communism has been eliminated from the earth. Now, if you don't want to clap, don't clap, because it's not that important, see? Some people struggle at it because they think I'm looking at them, and it doesn't make that much difference. See? Now listen, as far as the position of the Christian church, it has to be predicated upon God's position in this matter. And of course, you've got the outline of that in the New Testament. This force has made war against the church. It produces martyrs by the million. It's waged war against Christian civilization. Its design is to destroy all religion, all faith, and all your civilization and culture. Its design is to make war against you. It's gathering Africa and Asia for this purpose. It's creating race strife. It's seeking to overthrow the civilization and culture of white Christian leadership. And the scripture says that they will make war against the saints, the believing offspring of the Most High God, against his church, and against the people that are identified as Christian. to make war against your nations, against your culture. And God himself said, I will even bring in the hosts of heaven to defeat and help the children of my kingdom defeat this evil. You're outnumbered 6-1 in the world tonight, and you're still going to win because God's on your side. Now, armed with these facts, which I can point out over and over again, there is no point in my mind to ever ask quarter or seek quarter when dealing with a communist, but I would seek to stimulate an all-out program to break communism, defeat it all over the world, and set people free from an area of domination and conspiracy that is unequaled in the history of mankind. And never has there been so total an area of suppression afterwards, even since the days of Genghis Khan. I was in conference after the meetings in San Francisco till quite late on Monday night. And one of the men who was with us, we talked with, had just returned from Romania. His family lived in Romania, though he's an American citizen, has lived over here for some time, and has been over here since before the war. And when he left his family, why, they had fine farms, and some of them had businesses in town, and some of them had boats on a canal, barges hauling shipping for produce material. But the fact was that he said that their family had the finest of anything that they could acquire. They were a hard-working family. They had worked together. They acquired larger farms. They had fine homes. Everybody worked hard, but everybody shared in the family and worked for the good of the family. If a man wanted to go into merchandising, they helped to set him up and so forth. If he wanted to go into farming, the families worked that way, he said, all over. So he said, I look out over the countryside as I can remember it, and he said, I can see the great countrysides with wheat and with all kinds of grains going, with the cattle that were in the fields, with the gardens, and they hired to help also, as well as members of the family, keeping these great gardens going, the canning of vegetables and the packing of food, which was done every fall to carry us through the winter. And he said, transportation in those days, he said, there were some automobiles, yes, he said, about every family had at least one car, maybe in the family, but maybe never, not all the homes of the family. But he said there were ample carriages. We had horses, we had sleighs for the winter. But he said it was a sort of a happy civilization and society. He says the church played a very large part in the lives of our family. Now he said I came over long before the war. This man we know has been well employed in San Francisco. But about 6 months ago, he got a visa to go back and to visit his family in Romania. And so he went back to visit his family, and he said the moment he crossed the Iron Curtain, he said you could tell the difference in the standard of living between everything on the West and everything that was in the East. When eventually he came into his to the part of the country where his family lived in Romania, the first thing that he noted was that in the villages there were some well-kept houses, and that here and there were some mansions and houses that were seemed to be well kept with people keeping up the lawns, but all around, all the rest of the buildings were run down. And he said he noticed that the stores had very little to sell inside the stores, and that there were lines of people waiting at various food shops to buy food. He said that he noticed that the restaurants were didn't seem to be very good, and they looked poorer than what he said we'd expect to find out maybe on some road gang camp. And when he finally arrived at the family homesteads, where they had sections after section of land for various members of his family, and he says, when I came, I said, the barns weren't painted. Everything was run down. No cattle in the field. When he approached his own home, he said, here was this beautiful old home that I'd lived in, and he said, it was all run down. He said, everything was run down. No paint, no repair. He said, the great flocks of chickens, there was only a few little chickens. He says in one place, he says a goat or two, but the cattle were all gone. He said, I noticed that there were no horses, no carriages around. One plow horse I saw being plowed plowing off in one corner. And when I came into the house, why, he says the people were gone. He said, when I sat down to a meal, he said an American wouldn't want to eat it. It was a gruel made out of some garnered wheat that had been picked up from the ground after the harvesting. He says, we can't have any part of the harvest. He says, my family says the government takes all the harvest, and all we can have is the gleanings of what's left on the ground afterwards, or we can go down and buy back out of the wages, bigger though they are, that they are paid for producing goods, a small amount of money, they can go buy back what they can afford. They're not allowed to raise anything on their farm to feed their chickens or their goats. That's why they have no animals, and all the stock has long since been hauled off and butchered or taken somewhere else. He said that in this instance, he said, the only thing that anyone's allowed to reap is what grows along the roadside between the fences and the road. And he says, women out there with scythes cutting down grass and cutting down any weeds that might have any seeds so that they can feed their chickens and their goats on it back in home so that they can get some goat milk or that they can get some eggs from the chickens. He said, when they arrived, they said, oh, it must be so terrible for you. He says, why? Well, because of the starving situation in America. We understand that you don't have enough food and that the workers are dropping from lack of food and from hunger, and they can hardly make it, and there's practically no grain. And he said, well, where did you hear all this? Why? They said, why, we hear about it all the time. In fact, we have to go after work into the village and we have to listen there to a radio broadcast that tells us all about these things. And we have to look at photographs and pictures. Well, this man had brought with him a picture album, not even thinking he was just going to show them his family and what was going on here. So he said, well, you think that this is so? Let me show you something. He says, here's a picture of the market right down a short ways from where I live in San Francisco. And they said, this is a propaganda picture. He says, no, this is a supermarket in California. They said, you're not allowed to buy this. He says, yes, we can buy these groceries. We can have anything you see here in this market. He said, this is a supermarket. He said, the workers can buy all they want to buy here. They've got their wages, and they can buy all the things they want. And they showed him a picture of his home. And he had a car in the yard. There was two cars in the yard of his neighbor. And they said, who owns these cars? He said, that's my neighbor. And he says, well, there's cars in all these houses down the street. That's right. Nobody thinks anything of that in America. Everybody owns a car in their family as a rule. He said, that's how they get around. So in the course of time, the children said, have you ever seen ice cream? He said, why do you ask me that? Well, he says, the communists have made a great invention. They have made ice cream. And he says, there's a shop downtown where if our fathers have worked well, and they produced well, where they can get an extra tag and then go down there and they can get some ice cream. And we've had ice cream twice last year. Why, he says, ice cream, they've had ice cream in the United States way back since the days of the colonies. People made ice cream. And they said, when I was a boy, we used to make ice cream right here. And so they had forgotten these things. The children had thought the greatest thing was that there was one place in town where they could get ice cream, but they could only get it when their fathers behaved and so forth. Well, in the instance of his visit, he said, the only thing that I can tell that I was impressed with was this. The military are well fed. The military are well clothed, but the people have barely enough to eat. He said, I had intended to buy various goods in various places and bring them back to the United States, things that I would like to have bought, and I'd taken a certain amount of money along to do this, but he said, I didn't buy anything. I just tried to take my family out to a restaurant somewhere to buy them a dinner. And he said, the food was very bad, but they thought it was a banquet. And he says, we did this as long as I was there, as long as the money held out, because he said, these people have not properly eaten in all this time. And he said, now I want to make this clear. He said, Dr. Swift, the town is run by Jews. The nice houses were owned by Jews. They are the commissars. They are the managers of the village. They rule and control the countryside. And he says, they can pull labor off of those areas of the countryside. They keep up the lawns. They keep up their houses. The rest of the country's in disrepair because they don't have enough money for paint, for nails. They can't even buy a piece of lumber to repair. They have nothing. Everything they go has to go for food or something to cover their bodies. He says, these are white people, and they're under this bondage. They're under terrific propaganda. And he says, these people are no menace because they can't do anything. But the army is a menace because they're well fed. And the armies are told that they must liberate the world and they must bring good days back to their own country. And he said, when I talked to those that were in the army that were relatives, well, of course, they had one goal, to liberate the world from the terrible capitalists who had denied the rest of the world the things which the world needed. And he said, I want you to know that there is a menace from only one thing, and that's the military. Everything is being spent for weapons and for military. He said, you hear about progress? Yes, they'll have a show city here or there. They will put money into factories to make weapons, to make goods. He says, you don't buy washing machines or toasters or appliances, he said. A few of the wealthier party leaders, they have these things. And there's a few factories making inferior appliances. But he said the one thing that they're trying to make as fine as they can make it, it's weapons and military equipment. He said no one, he said, could travel over and back and not realize one thing about this, that they're placing everything they have, all their investment and all their future on the military. Make no mistake about it, one of these days that military is going to move against the West to see what they can gather out of the rest of Europe and loot. And that military is going to fight because they're the best fed and their future lies in being a Soviet military man. He said, when I came back to the United States, he said, I was the most disillusioned person in history. I had no sympathy for communism. But I believe their ideologies were different than ours. Their cruelty might exist. They might be in the areas of espionage and subversion deadly. They might shoot a spy. They might war on people. They might shoot somebody trying to escape. But I never could have believed that they would have taken over Europe and then have reduced the parts of Europe they took over to such abject poverty, such total areas of virtual slavery. He said it is an obvious fact that as a political, a social, and economic program, communism is a total failure. That it cannot produce for its society, for it would be sensible for any political and social and economic order to make it work as effectively as it can, to feed the people that are under it, to make them successful, to make them satisfied, to make them a part of that political society. He said, these people are without hope, and the only reason why they go along with supporting the society, even in their poverty, is because they've been told that these terrible conditions have hit all the world, and that we're suffering over here just as bad as they are over there, except for the capitalists. And he said, everywhere, the masters of Russia, he says, are the masters of Eastern Europe, and they are Jews from one end to the other, he said. So this was a rather interesting first-hand report. We also talked with one of our representatives who has been all over Africa, and he's been playing tapes in all parts of Africa. He's been from one end of the country to the other. And he was able to confirm the tremendous developments inside of Rhodesia, its gleaming white cities, its fine factories, the extensive agricultural development as white men went in and cleared the fields, and they developed the most adaptable crops, and they have been raising some of the finest sugar cane. They have fine sugar refineries, and one of the great products of Rhodesia is sugar, and they've been developing the mines, and they've been developing all areas of production. And the 220,000 white men that have been the masters both in intelligence and energy and output, he said whole areas of this had to be done by white men themselves. They couldn't get the Negroes to work. They didn't want to work. Eventually, when they saw there was some advantage to it, a lot of them have worked. But the only ones that have any intelligence or know anything are those the white man has taught. But they set up hospitals. They have carried sanitation out in the jungles. They have produced more food than had ever been estimated could be produced in an area like this. No reason for anybody to be hungry. But he says the revolt is coming from communist agitation. Red Chinese are all over inside of Africa. And so here are these Rhodesian tribesmen, red agitated and backed by the United Nations members, these other Negro states, which are nothing but a bundle of savages with striped trousers and a cutaway that have been used to figurehead for governments in their calling for the suppression of the Rhodesian government. He says the best reason why Rhodesia should maintain its white supremacy and should never surrender the control of that government is to look at Rhodesia itself. It is one of the most advanced areas. Wherever there's activity, wherever the jungles and the barren production areas have been entered by the white man, it has been made productive. It has produced food, and it has produced the needs of civilization. And the cities are modern and up to date, and they are clean and they're fine. And their educational facilities are here. And they have a job getting Negroes to want to learn. They don't want to go to school. They don't want to be taught. They will, some of them, be taught as in areas of working, because they've finally been convinced that they can have all kinds of things if they'll work for it. And they see the things that the white man has and the white man imports, and they want a lot of these things. It's like showing them a Sears and Roebuck catalog and say, you can have any of these things if you work for them. And so some of them have gone to work. But they, on the other side, they're being constantly taunted and attacked by the natives on the outside, saying, come on out, join us, and we're going to take all these things. Say, and everything is going our way. The communists have assured them that the United Nations is the way in which they will be given support to take everything the white man has and divide it up among themselves. So they live and dream for the day when they can pillage, they can rape, they can loot, and they can do what they did to the Congo in Rhodesia and these other places. And so again we say that John Smith is not only following the area of Christian responsibility when he said we will never integrate the areas of this government or the areas of education or any of the areas of white leadership in this country. We will keep our God-given responsibility for the good of all, and we will give them justice, and we will give them righteous government, but we will not permit it to be run down, and will not permit it to deteriorate by that which is less efficient, or that which wishes to loot or raid or pillage or go cannibal. Now in this instance, I want to call your attention that all the broadcasts are talking about the treasonable conduct of Jan Smith. The treasonable Jan Smith. I listen to Extra News, and they catch referring to the treasonable Jan Smith. And this week, of course, the premier, the socialist premier Wilson, has said that if they have to, they will use force and suppress this treasonable government if they do not respect the authority of the governor, who is still the Queen's governor there, and that this is treason. As I said before, they are attempting to make these men, because they're segregationist criminals, but you know, Jesus Christ is a segregationist too. And if Jesus Christ were to walk in the United Nations today, they would shout him down, or try to, just like they tried to cry out against him in the days when he walked in Palestine. Not only is Christ a segregationist, but he said, I'll separate the nations, and I will separate them as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. I'm going to say to these sheep nations, the white nations, the Christian nations, receive this kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Rule over these other nations with the firmness of the law, inflexible though it may be. It is a righteous law. And he says, this is my will and this is my purpose, that the areas of paganism, of darkness, of superstition shall not rule the world. The kingdom of God shall be in the hands of those that stand for truth and stand for the values of progress and civilization. Nowhere would they accept Jesus' position, but the thing I like about it is that Jesus doesn't ask them whether they like it or not anyhow. Since they're going to wage war on him, the moment they see him coming, he's going to totally defeat them in the hour of his return. Now, we point out to you that the Race Council in the United Nations has gone so far as to cite that next year is going to be one of the great years of mass immigration into the United States through executive patterns and through planned entrance and invasion. The design being, of course, that we have now knocked down the quota systems, and the pressure will be brought to more equitably distribute the areas of the Earth's surface, its raw materials and its goods. And they plan that they will import enough people to upset the great white majorities in our nation and be able to vote away, as they will be given full autonomy. And the part of the design of the so-called civil rights program is to see everybody, whether they can read or write or not, or no matter where they come from, get the chance to vote in this country. That's a part of the main conspiracy, and it violates the Constitution, with the state having the right to set up the qualifications of it. Make no mistake about it, the total plan of those that have control of much of the area of communication is to overthrow our Christian civilization, our Western way of life, absorb us, integrate us, take away even the sovereignty of our society, and make us just a province enslaved to a goal of world socialism. We don't have to accept it. We don't have to go along with it. We're still the majority in these United States. It's our job to wake up that majority and then turn them with fixed determination that they will not go along or permit this thing to develop. So it says, how are you going to stop it? Anytime you've got three-quarters of the people, you'll find a way to stop it. And that's the one goal that Americans must undertake. And they're more worried about this than anything else. In discussion that was held in Washington by the liberal one-worlders connected with this program, they cited that the great danger on the horizon was the speed with which conservative organizations are expanding. They must be totally crushed. Then comes the Anti-Defamation League, citing that the inroads being made into all areas of education are extensive, as parents are being roused against the areas of progressive and liberal education. Well, after a little experiment with what that is involving when the federal government gets in the areas of education, it's understandable that this is taking place. I thought it rather interesting that now from New Jersey comes the Attorney General of New Jersey. The Attorney General of New Jersey said that we must find some way to ban all extremist armed groups. He says, we are now having what we call the Sills Study Bill. This is Attorney General Arthur Sills, to find out how to take away the armed military organizations of the conservatives. So they automatically can see that the conservatives have armies. So he said, similar to California, where there was the Nazi Party, the State Rights Party, the California Rangers, the Minutemen, the Muslims, and so forth, we in New Jersey are determined that we will not have the armed forces, private armies, that exist in these other parts of the country. He says, therefore, he says, we are now circulating copies of bulletins from right-wing organizations right here in California, which are calling on all their patriotic members, he says, to be armed so they can defend themselves. The dangerous thing, they say, about these armed forces are that whenever you get patriotic conservatives, as they call themselves, armed, they are ready to make war in defense of what they believe is the country against everything they disagree with. And thus, many innocent people who disagree with them can have their lives endangered and can be killed. So he said it is going to be our responsibility to try to join with these other states in disarming all of the conservative organizations and all of their private armies. And he goes a little farther with this deal, and he said it is that he has information from the Justice Department, the House Un-American Activities, Attorney Generals of Delaware, Michigan, California, Louisiana, and all states concerning bulletins. And he said he has material that says that the attempt to infiltrate the National Guard by conservatives has been taking place all over. And this is one of the good things about the dissolving of reserve forces and guards and folding up these organizations, is that there will not be an ability of the conservatives to take these organizations over. So this shows why McNamara may have dismissed 5,500 units of our reserve and have dislocated more military strength inside these United States than an enemy could have knocked out in 5 years of warfare. Well, anyhow, why are they worried about conservatives? Why don't somebody come along and say, we've got to disarm the communists, we've got to disarm black Muslims, we've got to disarm the forces that are trying to overthrow the United States government? Why do they worry about people that want to defend the government and show no attempt to do anything about those that are trying to disarm the government? Now, I'm going to tell you something. There's just not enough federal power to disarm the people of these United States. You say, why? I'll tell you why. Because the Constitution of the United States says that the right to have, own, and bear arms shall not be infringed on. Someone says, yes, in order to be able to form a well-regulated militia. Well, a militia are people's armies ready to defend their homes and support their government. That's exactly what it is. And you know, your right to have, own and bear arms at an area where law enforcement breaks down or your country's in threat, you have a right to stand up and defend it. Now, this is the Constitution, this is the Bill of Rights. If you try to throw that out, you try to take that away, then people will say the government is the Constitution, the government are not these phonies. And they'll bury those arms, they'll hide those arms, but they'll not surrender them. And you'd have to have 50 million people to go out and disarm the rest of the nation. And I don't think you're going to be able to find them, and I don't think you're ever going to be able to disarm the citizens of the United States. In fact, I think before we know it, and even some of the silly liberals in Washington, the race riots, the communist revolution, the violence of attack is going to be on us, and it's going to crystallize an action that's going to throw out of office every one of these people that were seeking to appease Reds. And a great new militant America is going to rise up, and communism is going to be crushed like the cockatrice's eggs in these United States. It is a significant thing that again we have the report of the fact that they are worried about militant churches. And when these disarming units say that a militant church may be more dangerous than any type of military or political organization, they say this is because when it believes that its members should be able to defend their homes and could call on their members to stand up at any given moment in time, then they are a potential army just waiting for the signal to be called. But let's warn these attorney generals that the Supreme Court says that even if you advocated it, you can't do anything about it until it's done. I'm going to tell you, when 149 million people stand up and say, onward Christian soldiers, it's going to put the stars and stripes right back up on the highest pedestal it's ever been on. It is rather interesting, again, that in the face of all of the design to advocate the patterns of enforced equality, that while this procedure is going on, the very forces that are calling for it are asking for discrimination in their behalf. This very week has shown violence in four places in the United States by organized and concerted action of CORE and these other Negro organizations. And so under these instances, we point out that it's much later than many people think. It's not coming down. It's getting ready for the big move. We have a lot of communications that come from law enforcement agencies throughout the country, that show that they thoroughly know and they're aware that this thing can break out. We have been threatened that between the Thanksgiving and Christmas season that there's going to be trouble and riots and turmoil all over the United States. We would say that any who think that the Christian civilization and society of this country will permit these holidays to be disrupted and take this thing without any reaction, they're very, very, very much mistaken. America has been pushed just as far as they're going to let irresponsible, emotionally immature people push them before they explode. So we again cite that something rather significant takes place in another facet. A top intelligence officer that's worked with Secret Service has come back from Cuba. His information is that the top Moscow-trained communists, many of them Cuban communists, and a great number of them trained right in Cuba, who are thoroughly loyal to Castro, thoroughly loyal to the communist revolution, hardcore military saboteurs, direct actionists, and they have been in schools and they have been in training camps where for the last few weeks they have gone through concentrated instruction. And they are being infiltrated at about a 50% rate among the Cubans that are coming to America for freedom. And this man himself, a Cuban, a Secret Service agent, reports that over 50% of all the Cubans that are being brought in the United States are a hardcore trained fifth column set of regiments of the communist world revolution, Moscow and Cuba combined. And that means that we have in the United States, and for instance, I have a newspaper that from Mojave in which there's talk of putting 2,000 of these Cubans on an old Marine base and rehabilitating the facilities for residents there and employing them at our Air Force bases and throughout the areas where some top secret missile work and everything else is going on. And they said, of course, there's plenty and ample employment, and they will not seek to absorb all the employment from those that are local in the area, but they're talking about the benefits that will come from this, because basically they said this will mean another 2,000 marketeers to buy food on the markets, to trade in the stores, that business will expand, the Catholic Church will have to build a bigger facilities to handle so many of the new communicants, and so they're trying to sell them a bill of goods right now to put 2,000 in the area of the Mojave Desert. Well, let me tell you something. There's not 2,000 jobs there, and the government says, don't let that worry you. There'll be insufficient assistance to make a heavy contribution to the community if they put them in there. Any intelligent part of our country would know that they take any mass of these people and put them anywhere is a hardship. And the dispersion of them over areas where they might be absorbed might be considered. But I think that they should not permit them to expand until they have thoroughly screened each and every person and they have checked this out. You can't afford to bring in regiments of communist-trained saboteurs. We haven't anything against Cubans that are trying to flee from communism. We sympathize with them. They've been under one of the most vicious things in the world. We feel that they were betrayed by President Kennedy and that the forces of America should have joined in liberating all Cuba and restoring the status of a good republic back to Cuba without communism. But because that failure took place, the whole nation should not be penalized by absorbing so many regiments of communism as we are bringing in. He says because of the size of a communist regiment is smaller than ours, and there's more regiments in their division. But the fact remains that we are bringing in regiments of agents, spies, and trained saboteurs right now. When are we going to wake up? This is the same old Trojan horse. Why do you think Castro agreed to let these people be brought into the United States? You say, oh, because he couldn't feed them all. Listen, the amount that this doesn't make enough differential to him as far as the feeding factor is concerned. It was because he wanted to accomplish this objective. The Soviet Union wanted to accomplish this objective. During the war, we took in refugees that fled across the Iron Curtain. And then we had special measures to bring them to America, to South America, and they were imported and brought in. And we were working very closely with Internal Security, and we had the files, the materials, and the records of the Immigration Department, and the follow-up on it. And about 30 to 50% of all these people were not fleeing from Russian bayonets. They were running on a full-scale show across the line in front of those bayonets, so that they could get into the United States. If they tried to cross the line with a visa, they couldn't have come in. But if they came running ahead of red bayonets, they could come in and be welcome. And that's how the Reds pushed across with a Trojan horse thousands of communists that are right now in the Western Hemisphere. And the only thing that has been more successful than that is all the refugee Jews that poured in the United States. They are not only the power behind world communism, but they are the most traitorous evil force that ever moved anywhere in the world. As we make our announcements for this week, we urge you to help fill this auditorium. We don't think it's going to rain so hard. It's going to flood you out. We think that we've got most of the rain. Lots of people worry about rain. Don't worry about the rain, my friends. Just worry about the drought. You got more to worry about from the fire when they say, burn, baby, burn, than you have to worry from the rain. Anyhow, we're speaking Sunday afternoon on the following subjects. Steady to show thyself approved. What does this entail? Steady to show thyself approved. The Sunday night subject is battling the sons of darkness. This is the sons of darkness versus the sons of light. This is a biblical record of history and destiny and prophecy, and it is an identified interpretation of things that relate to our hour, classifying them as biblical vision has classified them through the ages. So do not forget this subject. Let's fill this auditorium. We understand well why many people have gone tonight to hear Mr. Cotton while he's in this area. We urge you to bring someone with you. Let's fill this auditorium. We anticipate that everybody that was not here tonight will put in two offerings Sunday to help meet up the expense. But right now, we still have to buy tape. When we have to buy tape, it takes thousands of dollars, and we can't stop the vast network. I want you to know that nothing has been more successful than your investment in this missionary enterprise. And the success of it is measured by the number of people you're reaching and the number of people that are writing, the number of people that are carrying and spreading this all over the world. Your opinions and the views of your faith and the awakening of people to their Christian responsibility is spreading worldwide. You're identified with these views, but they're biblical, they are Christian, they are historically yours as a society and a race, and they belong to you as a nation. So one thing about it, we don't have to please our enemies, but we do have to declare the truth whether they like it or not. So hold up our hands tonight. Help us reach people with the truth. Help send out these messages from one end of the nation to the other. And so as we take this offering, let God guide you in your giving. We very vitally need your assistance to meet this area of responsibility. Almighty and eternal Father, look thy blessing to rest upon this congregation. Bless this offering. Multiply it to carry forward the gospel of thy kingdom through the mighty work of thy church, and we'll give thee the thanks. Amen. It's a rather significant thing that we hear constant testimony concerning your missionary activity. People come in from all over the country, and they tell us about how they first got on the tape circuit, and then they found out where the headquarters were, how they wanted to see and they wanted to talk. People stand amazed that they watch the wheels of equipment turning and see workers sending out tape by the thousands. The important thing is that tape is being made many, many times thousands as they go out. They're being copied. They're being duplicated. One man told me that he played tape 5 nights out of the week. 5 nights after he gets home from work, he goes out and plays tape. Only Saturday and Sunday are the only times when he's not playing tape, and then he meets with another great big tape group on Sunday morning. This man said that he not only does he have this experience, but every place where he plays tape, there's one and two tape recorders taking it down. And he said that he's followed this up, that these people are playing tape. And he said he's gone down the line 5 chains, like a chain letter, and every place that tape is being played in the circuit, somebody else is copying it, sometimes one, sometimes two, and sometimes three, and on it goes. From Africa, we get letters. They said, Dr. Swift, we had to cut back on our contribution this month because we're buying more tape recorders so that we can spread the tape faster, and we can't make as heavy a contribution as if we didn't have to buy these tape recorders. So we want to assure you that we'll be back with strong support, but we've got to spread it. Another cleric writes, we're playing the tapes in our Dutch Reformed churches. More Dutch Reformed churches are playing tape. He says, the tape, your church, this ministry, is known from one end of Africa to the other. And wherever white men now meet, they know about tape, and tape is spreading. South Africa, I haven't the time to tell you tonight about the Bantu government, but I think it's most interesting. And we'll tell you in the near future. So let's remember this, be out Sunday. Let's fill this auditorium. Shall we stand? Almighty and eternal Father, folks, the unction of thy Holy Spirit and benediction, rest upon these thy children, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.